Well, hello and welcome to Breaking the Taboo. Well, I have a surprise for our regular listeners today, which is that Breaking the Taboo has been on the road and today's episode is a special live from the Every Woman Festival in Wales. So here is the panel discussion that I took part in Cardiff, where we discuss the changing landscape in women's health. I'll hand over now to the panel chair, live from the Every Woman Festival in Cardiff.
So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the final session of the day in the main tent, which is changing the narrative in women's health. So a really important subject. I'm delighted to be joined by the panel. So on the panel, we have Rosie Taylor, Theo Clark and Elora Baroness Finley of Llandaff. I'm Diane Dansebrink. I'm the founder of Menopause Support. I've spent about a decade campaigning for better menopause care and support for everybody. So this was a delight to say yes to when Julie said, we've got this session, I think this might suit you. So to introduce the panel, so glasses on. So Rosie is an award-winning freelance journalist who specialises in investigating women's health, parents' rights and family diets. She writes for a wide range of national news publications, including The Times, The Telegraph, The Independent and The Guardian. Rosie's passionate about helping people get their voices heard in the media and runs a service called Get Featured, teaching people how to do that. She's also the creator and host of Mother Bodies, her podcast focusing on postnatal health and why it matters. Theo is a former Member of Parliament. She chaired the first parliamentary inquiry into birth trauma in British history and set up the all-party parliamentary group on birth trauma in the House of Commons. Theo is the founder of the Global Birth Trauma Alliance, a movement working to prevent and reduce birth trauma for women around the world. Theo's book, Breaking the Taboo, Why We Need to Talk About Birth Trauma, was recently published, and she also hosts the Breaking the Taboo podcast, and this session is being recorded live for that podcast. And we have Elora Baroness Finley of Llandaff, who has been a crossbench peer in the House of Lords for more than 20 years. She's also currently a deputy speaker. Her policy interests include health services, medicine and medical ethics. Elora was on the Assisted Dying Bill Select Committee and co-edited the book The Reality of Assisted Dying, Understanding the Issues. She's a pioneering and passionate palliative medicine doctor. She established Marie Curie's Penarth Hospice and is Vice President of Cardiff's City Hospice. So a big welcome to the panel and thank you so much for taking the time to join us. So Rosie is going to kick us off and she's going to be talking about changing the narrative, how women's health is portrayed in the media.
Hi, thanks Diane for the introduction and thank you to you all for sticking it out to the end of the day. As I mentioned, this is me. My podcast is available on all podcast players. As well as being a journalist, I am really passionate about making sure that people's voices are heard in the media. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So today I'm going to talk about women's health and how it's portrayed in the media. I'm going to go back in time and talk about how it's been portrayed historically, what's different now, what's changing, and what we can do in the future to make sure that the kind of coverage that we see is informative, educational, empowering, positive, and not anything else that it may have been. To talk about where we are now, first of all, we've got to talk about where we've come from. And it's important to recognise that since the invention of the printing press, the media has basically been dominated and controlled by men. It was only last year, for the first time in history, that women made up 50% of the journalism workforce for the first time. Only 25% of news stories globally are about women. So we're still very much seeing things through a male perspective, male gaze. But it's also important to recognise that media doesn't exist in isolation. So the media is a reflection of society. The kind of topics that are covered in the news, the kind of topics that the general public is interested in is talking about anyway. So we do also need to kind of look at ourselves and reflect a bit on what we're talking about and how we're portraying women's bodies when we're talking about media coverage. So I wanted to start by taking you back more than 80 years, the 1940s. This is an advertisement that was published at the time. And it's for essentially a women's health product. This is some kind of deodorant for underwear, as far as I can work out, called Lux for Underthings. And, you know, this is a women's body issue, but there's nothing in this advertising that's about informing women why this might happen or explaining it. There's nothing here to normalise this. It's all about portraying the fact that this bodily function is something that might offend men, and as a result might mean that women can't get a husband. So the language is all around, don't offend people, you need to protect your daintiness. Move forward a decade to 1950s. This is an advert for toothpaste, but again, the theme is very much, your breath might make your man leave you for another woman. So once again, we're not talking about informing, we're not educating women. It's all very much framed around this idea that a woman's body is only important in as far as it can help her get or keep a husband. Now, it's kind of easy to laugh at these as like old-fashioned misogynist adverts, but actually, like, the 1950s is not ancient history. Like, if you were born in the late 1950s, you're still not at pension age now. So you were raised around this messaging. Your mother certainly was raised around this messaging. And this was absolutely normal in society at the time. So we have made quite big strides forward. I don't think you would see adverts like this today, but we do have still quite a lot of work to do. But I think it's worth recognising how far we've come in just a couple of generations. Having said that, so this is an article from 2008 in The Telegraph. And to me, 2008 seems really recent, but I was rudely reminded that it is actually nearly 20 years ago. But so this was an article about the Duchess at the time, who is now our Queen, Camilla. And she announced that she was going to hospital to have a hysterectomy. Now, I don't think she actually publicly announced why, but the very fact that a hysterectomy had been mentioned publicly led to The Telegraph running a full-page article talking about the excruciating embarrassment of the fact that people knew about this. So the language in this article is quite astonishing. It talks about the embarrassing stigma, the alarming procedure, and the sentence at the end of the intro, hysterectomy is a word to be whispered. It makes women feel anxious and men feel queasy. So even in 2008, here we are still worried that men might feel queasy because they know that someone's womb is being operated on. Fast forward a few years, have things changed much? Well, in 2012, AOL was writing, do you remember AOL? They were a thing. Writing headlines about women daring to have arms. And then 2015, so only 10 years ago, and this article is still live on the Women's Health website today. We're moving towards educational and informational content, but again, still framed in this like idea of shame and stigma. You know, they could kind of claim that they're trying to help women by raising awareness, but, you know, consider yourself very lucky if you don't have one of these disorders. It's not very helpful. And just in case you thought that we'd left that 1940s, 50s messaging that a woman's body is only useful in terms of how it will help her keep her husband behind, this was on the front page of the Daily Mail last month. So, yeah, we have made strides forward. We still have some work to do. But things are changing. So in 2022, I wrote this double page spread for the Daily Telegraph, and it's all about postnatal incontinence. This is the same Daily Telegraph that 14 years ago thought the word hysterectomy was so embarrassing that they had to write an entire article about it. So we've made a huge step forward. This article is, you know, I'm not totally chuffed by the headline describing it as a secret issue, but the whole article is about postnatal incontinence, raising awareness. It's got practical tips about what you can do if you have these symptoms. It talks about how it has long-term impacts in menopause, not just after birth. So this is kind of the useful educational content that I would love to see more of in the mainstream media. I wondered if this was the first time in its 170 odd year history that the Telegraph had used the words postnatal incontinence, but no, it had in fact mentioned it twice before. And the very first mention was in 2018 when the chief medical officer at the time, Dame Sally Davies, talked about her own personal experience. And this is why it is so important for women in positions of power, authority, medical professionals, celebrities, when they talk about their health, it really does open the door to these conversations being had more publicly. And it helps, you know, Dame Sally talking about this in 2018 really was one of the major steps forward to us being able to publish that double page spread in 2022. Since then, and these are just a few of the headlines that I've written over, well, I don't write the headlines, just to clarify, the headlines on the articles that I've written over the years. I'm just one journalist. There are lots of us covering women's health. You may recognise some of those faces. So I think the floodgates in a way have opened that, you know, lots more of this kind of informative, awareness-raising stuff is being published. And that's great. I do still think we've got progress to be made. There's still quite a lot of euphemistic language in those headlines. Lots of mention of the word taboo. And things like, you know, describing things as women's health and sensitive data. You know, we've got some way to go before we see the word like prolapse or vulva in a headline of a mainstream newspaper, I think. But we are making progress. What's driving that change? Well, there are three main things. One, as I mentioned, is there are more women journalists, but also there are more women in senior roles, and that's so important. Because when commissioning editors are women, they recognise the issues that are important to women, and they realise that there's like thousands, if not millions, of people wondering about these issues and wanting to know more information about them. So that's been a real big driver. Publications are also more interested in appealing to female readers. They've recognised that we are important consumers in society and they want us to be clicking on and reading and buying their publications. But the increase in publication of articles around women's health, I think, has also been massively driven by social media. Because social media has been such this incredible tool for giving women a voice to talk about things that the mainstream media wasn't talking about. And, you know, because we've been sharing our stories, experts have been coming and sharing their information, we've been engaging with that content, that publications are following. They want to follow what we're talking about. As I said, media is a reflection of society. So actually, you know, a lot of that changes us. It's you. You know, the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that this event is happening today, that's why these articles are getting out there and that information is getting out into the public. And these are just a few of the wonderful people, many of whom are here today, who are helping spread that word on social media in a really positive way. So what can we do to ensure things are better in future? So, number one, this is a particular bugbear of mine. If you see a headline that is misogynistic, it's sexist, it frames women in that 1940s way, you can call it out. We have the power now. Like, you can tag a publication. You can actually just email the managing editor's office. And it's really helpful because publications are listening. They want you to read them. And if enough people start complaining, it really will filter through. And it's also really helpful for us journalists who don't write the headlines that are on top of our articles to make sure that, like, things, you know, those big black letters above what can be a really informative article are sensible and helpful and reassuring and not inflammatory. Two and three kind of go together. I think, you know, we all need to take responsibility to make sure that the kind of material that we are reading and engaging with is responsible, it's reliable, it's trustworthy, it's evidence-backed. And I use a thing called Think Five. So basically what this means is when you see something on social media and you think, oh my God, before you do anything, before you like it, before you share it, before you send it to a friend, before you comment, even if you want to comment to say, this is a load of rubbish, just take 5 seconds to just pause. And in those 5 seconds, you think, who is this person? What are their qualifications? Where's their evidence for this? What are they trying to achieve by posting this? And are they trying to sell me something? Because so often, basically the algorithms, it promotes engagement. It doesn't care whether the content is quality or not. So even if someone is outright lying on social media, if it's creating a lot of buzz, that's the content that's going to get pushed out the most widely. So if we can all think five before we engage and then only engage with the stuff that is great, then hopefully all that rubbish can disappear to the bottom and all the good stuff can rise to the top. That's my dream, my very unrealistic dream anyway. And finally, you know, we need to get our knowledge out there. If you're an expert, we want to hear from you. Like, the media needs your voices as expert voices. We want to hear your clinical expertise, your academic information, research. And if you're just a member of the public, but you have experienced a condition or you want to raise awareness or something, you want to highlight something, then if you feel comfortable doing so, then it's great to hear your stories too, because it's only by sharing our stories with each other that we get this information out there. So that's it from me. If you want to know more, including getting in touch with me about any articles, that top QR code goes to my website and you can follow me on socials, Rosie Taylor Journalism. If you are an expert and you're interested in knowing more about pitching yourself to the media, I run Get Featured, which is a service basically teaching people how to talk to the national press. And I have weekly newsletter, and that bottom QR code will give you 10% off that. And that's me. Thank you.
Rosie, thank you very much.
When I needed help after my birth trauma, Erwin Mitchell's team of experts provided the support I needed to rebuild my life.
At Erwin Mitchell, we work closely with our clients through any challenges. We understand the impact of a birth injury and can help get the best medical support and rehabilitation for our clients and their families. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
So now Theo is going to talk to you about lessons from the UK birth trauma inquiry.
Well, good afternoon, and it's wonderful to be here in Cardiff today at the Every Woman Festival. And I'm particularly delighted that today's episode is being recorded for Breaking the Taboo. And Rosie, I think you kicked us off so well with the topic by your very insightful presentation, looking at how sort of approach to gender has changed in the news in the last sort of few decades. And what I really wanted to talk today about was about women's health policy and why it's been traditionally ignored by government, but why we really need to do something about it. And I'll talk a bit about the birth trauma inquiry and some of the lessons on maternity which we found during that campaign in Parliament. And I should start off by saying that I'm a former politician, but the reason I say that is because it's important to say that I was only the 56th female MP in British history to give birth while elected as an MP. And that's really the place I want to start, is why is it that women's health has traditionally been ignored in government policy? And I think it actually goes right back to that point, which is that representation in Parliament at the moment is not representative of the British public. So we know that women make up 51% of our population, but we are nowhere near having gender parity and 50-50 in the House of Commons. And I wanted to start off by making that point, because what politicians choose to champion and talk about in Parliament and ultimately get into legislation and the laws that we all follow as citizens and as businesses in the UK is directly decided by legislators. And the legislators that we currently have in Parliament are not representative of the UK and do not include enough women, which is why women's health has been traditionally ignored as a topic. And the reason I ended up starting talking about maternity, for those of you who've not heard my story before, is because when I was an MP and gave birth in the last Parliament, I suffered from a very traumatic birth. And I decided when I came back from my maternity leave to talk about it very publicly in the chamber of the House of Commons. And very unexpectedly, I burst into tears during my debate on birth trauma. And it was really that moment of kind of emotional connection with the public which led to this huge outpouring of you all sending me your stories from the public to me and another MP, Rosie Duffield, where you shared your stories of very bad maternity care or when you'd had complications in birth. And the birth trauma inquiry came about because over 1,300 families contacted myself and Rosie to share your stories. And I just wanted to talk about that in detail, because I think so many of the things that we heard during the birth trauma inquiry are really indicative of women's health policy in general and why it's not talked about enough. And an important point about women's health is I was really surprised as a then politician to discover that the Women's Health Strategy published in 2022 was in fact the first. I remember when I was first writing a speech about this in Parliament, I just assumed it was an annual strategy that was being published. And I was very shocked to discover that that was not the case, particularly given we're more than half of the population. I think it begs thinking about that question of why is that? Why is it things like the menopause? Why is it periods? Why are all these topics not being widely discussed in society? And why is it that there does seem to be a stigma or a taboo associated with talking about these subjects? And I hope that by people like myself talking very publicly about it in the chamber of the House of Commons, it has started a national conversation to say there is no need to feel shame about speaking about this. It's really important that women do get access to the help and the support that they need. And that starts by us listening to women. And that's really my first sort of headline lesson from the Birth Trauma Inquiry. It was very clear from reading and listening to the very powerful testimony from the families that gave evidence that women in the UK are not being listened to. We heard some really devastating testimony of families who had the most appalling experiences and did not receive the right level of care postnatally. And that's something that we really need to do something about. And what I've been publicly calling and campaigning for is for the government to implement a number of changes to the NHS in terms of care that we provide mums. And the types of evidence that we discovered during our inquiry range from, firstly, this postcode lottery in maternity care across the UK. And I personally didn't find it acceptable that depending on where you live in this country, you will actually receive a different level of care for you and your baby, depending on where you live. And I remember the moment I first discovered that was the case. I had reached out to the Birth Trauma Association on Facebook, and I remember their chief executive, Kim, coming to my office in the House of Commons for a coffee. And to be honest, she said to me, "Thea, why am I here?" Because at the time, I was not somebody who'd spoken a lot about healthcare policy. I tended to talk about international affairs. And I told her my story of suffering from a birth injury and going on to develop PTSD. And she invited 10 other mothers to come in and to meet with me in Parliament and to hear their stories. And they were very shocking. They ranged from people with, you know, fourth degree tear who'd had to drop out of the workplace entirely, weren't able to go back to work, to mothers who'd suffered from baby loss, to women who'd had injuries to their children during forceps delivery. So really shocking and devastating testimony. But the thing that really stayed with me after that meeting was that they all lived in different parts of the same country and they were all being offered different types of care. So why was it that when I live in Stafford, I was offered a specialist tear clinic for my birth injury and there was a waiting list, but I did get offered that help. But you could live 50 miles down the road in an adjacent constituency and there wouldn't be the same specialist training that would be provided in your particular NHS trust. So that was really what opened my eyes to the postcode lottery in the UK. But also the other thing that came through very strongly in the evidence was how I think in the UK at the moment we have a real focus firstly on the pregnant mum and then when you give birth on looking after your newborn baby. But I think we've forgotten that there's another patient post-birth and that's the mum. And I think we really need to have a very hard look in the UK at what is the postnatal care that we provide to mothers. And I'll just share a story that I heard from an academic during one of our evidence sessions. And she had a very good description where she said, in the UK, we treat the pregnant mum like a sweet in a wrapper. And then we eat the sweet and we throw the wrapper away. And the mum in this case is the wrapper. And I just want to share a couple of sort of personal stories on that and things that I heard, which I think really illustrate this point that we need as politicians and government to be investing in women's health and particularly prioritising maternity care. Because there are so many moments in our current care pathway where the mum is not being considered. So the first one that I really came across was the GP 6-week checkup appointment. So I don't know about you all, but I had my appointment at 6 weeks and I had a 15-minute appointment. And the first 14 minutes was all about my daughter, who, by the way, was absolutely fine. She didn't have any issues at all post-birth. And in the very last minute, I was asked, do you suffer from postnatal depression? yes or no. Oh, and secondly, you have 1 minute left to answer that question. So let's just think about that for a moment. Firstly, is that acceptable that the mother is basically completely cut out of the appointment? And secondly, how on earth can you talk about mental health and something so important and not be given the time and the space to think about it? So one of the first things that I campaigned for as an MP was to change that and to say that at the GP checkup, firstly, it needs to be mandatory and everybody must be offered it at the full 6 weeks because it's not currently national. But also to make this point that we shouldn't just be looking at the health of the baby, but also about the mum. And I was really pleased that the government did agree as a result of my campaign to change that. And there will now be a question about the mum's physical and mental health post-birth at that checkup appointment. And really gets to the core of kind of what this panel is talking about is that this matters, policy matters, what we decide to focus on as politicians impacts on all of you in your everyday lives. Like the next mum who's having a baby is going to get asked that question at that checkup. So when people say to me, like, why does politics matter? Why does policy matter? This impacts on all of you and everybody going forward in this country to have access to the right level of care, which is why it's so incredibly important. The other thing that we looked at was very specific recommendations to make trusts be more joined up. We found some really shocking statistics about disparities in maternity care, particularly the very worrying statistic that black mums were 5 times more likely to have complications or die in childbirth. I find that unacceptable. That's something the government needs to do. So we heard from over 1,300 families over the space of about 4 months to give evidence. And we came up with an 82-page report to the then Prime Minister, which had more than 40 recommendations in it on how to improve maternity care. And I just wanted to share with you what our headline recommendations were. And the first was this need for a standardised maternity policy. So I think we all talk about this concept of the National Health Service, but actually the National Health Service is not national. The service that you will be offered in different parts of the UK will vary and will change. And I found it very interesting going to visit with clinicians and doctors in different hospitals to hear directly from them how even they found it confusing as our medical professionals. So, for example, I went to the St George's Hospital in Tooting with other members of parliament from the all-party parliamentary group for birth trauma. I remember one clinician said to me he referred to nearly 100 different documents to work out what should be the maternity policy in that hospital. So that's the doctor who can't even work out what the policy should be. And I remember going to Number 10 and asking this question of Downing Street to say, can I read as the chair of the inquiry what the maternity policy is? And there actually wasn't one single standardised policy. So just let that sink in for a moment. I think that explains so much about why our healthcare is not joined up and there is such silos across different NHS trusts. So one of the things that I've been calling for with our report, which was a cross-party recommendation, is to have a national maternity improvement strategy, and that needs to be standardised across every hospital in the UK. And I suppose what I find really disappointing is that I remember last year, this time, standing up in the Chamber of the House of Commons and asking a question of the then Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, to ask for that to be implemented. And it was actually accepted by the previous government and announced as a new policy. And now a year on, when even more families have come forward with very shocking stories of poor postnatal care, that policy has not yet been adopted by the new government. So really a call also to all of you to keep lobbying your MPs and politicians to make the case to say that is not acceptable and the government does need to take action. We know what the issues are. We know how to address them. And now it's for the government to prioritise and to do something about it. We also asked for a maternity commissioner because having worked in the government, I know how incredibly siloed government departments can be. And it's a bit like wading through treacle sometimes, trying to get ministers to do things. So actually, I think having a dedicated champion for all of us to be a maternity commissioner who could really be our champion in government, and most importantly, to report directly to the Prime Minister, would make a huge difference in terms of maternity. So there is so much that we could do to improve care in this country for mums. And I think my lesson to the government is listen to mothers, like you all know what is the care improvements that you would like to be seen. And the fact that 100,000 women gave evidence to the Women's Health Strategy Inquiry, we had over 1,300 families who wrote to us. I think the time for calling for evidence is over. It's now say, we know what the changes are, and now it's about government taking action to implement them. So thank you all for coming today. And if I have one plea to all of you, it's to keep up the pressure on the government and keep making the case that prioritising and funding maternity care and safety is an absolute priority. Every single person in this country is going to be born. This is a cross-cutting issue which affects all of us, and we all need the government to do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you to Theo. I think one of the things that really strikes me listening to everything that I've heard today is women not being heard. And if there is a reason for us all to raise our voices, then that's it in terms of all aspects of women's healthcare. So now Ilora is going to speak to us, and Ilora is going to bring us the clinician and House of Lords perspective on this subject. Ilora.
Thank you so much for that background, and there's been some things that have happened this week. So I am lucky enough to be in the House of Lords, and this is the amazing chamber in which we are, and I'm a crossbencher. And why that's important for me is I'm politically independent, and that means I can vote with my conscience on whatever I feel strongly about, and I can speak however I want. I'm not subject to any party rules. You heard from Theo exactly that more than half of the country are women. But actually, in the House of Lords, we're about 30% women, which is not bad, but it's not up to 50% yet. And we do have the highest number of people who are disabled from, I think, all the legislatures around the world. So we're doing not too badly on that. And I have the great privilege, I now share an office with Tani Gray Thompson, which is great fun, actually. And we work really hard. But there we go. So I thought I'd tell you about really what I've been doing just in relation to the three main areas of influence that we have. One is about asking questions. The other is about legislating. And the third is about committee work and how I hope that that affects everybody's life for a positive way. Recent questions, and I'm still trying to get another one in, is about accident and emergency waits. Any of you that have had to wait for an ambulance or wait with a relative, you'll know how traumatic that is. Carbon monoxide, because homes did not have carbon monoxide alarms, new homes didn't. Women cooking quite often were exposed to carbon monoxide, and their children, because their heads are at the level of the cooker, often were inhaling carbon monoxide from poorly maintained gas cookers. And then we heard about tragic deaths, obviously, of people who'd gone camping and so on. Again, it's the women who are carrying the burden of carbon monoxide poisoning. And there is evidence that exposure during pregnancy damages the developing heart and possibly the developing brain in the fetus. I've also been concerned about asbestos in schools. Most teachers are women. I know they're not all women, but, you know, we have our girls going to schools, we have women teachers, and the incidence of mesothelioma, which is the cancer from asbestos, is high amongst teachers. And we have asbestos deposits in our school that need to come out. And then, obviously, because I'm a hospice doctor, I do go on with questions about hospices. And we will all die, and we all want good care. And just as Theo has pointed out, it's a postcode lottery. When you come to palliative care, it's even more patchy than maternity services. And we know that hospices are only about 33% funded by the NHS. The rest is from all of you generously giving. What about legislation? Well, I was concerned about all the lung cancer patients I had. So I wrote the first bill to ban smoking in public places. Mine got nowhere. But it didn't matter because the government of the day picked it up. And so we got that through. I got a chief coroner in. That was quite a difficult campaign to have a chief coroner because I found that parents, again, particularly mothers, were not having their questions answered because the coroner's services were really patchy around the country. Palliative care just got it into health and care legislation. I got 80% of what I wanted, not 100%, but then that's the way life goes in politics. And I've just finished a palliative care commission trying to improve the care for people who are dying everywhere. I was involved in veterans. I won't go on too much about that. But child protection is something really near to my heart, and that's my job tomorrow. Day after tomorrow, Monday, I'm going to try and increase the protection for children against being hit in the name of smacking. And then I've been chaired a select committee on allergy, again, trying to make sure that children who went to school and forgot their allergy pen, the school would have a spare one so that we didn't have children dying from anaphylaxis in schools. Carbon monoxide legislation has changed. We've been pushing on asbestos and running inquiries. Science teaching, because girls were missing out on science teaching. I was on a select committee looking at that. And safe housing, again, because women as carers were often trying to care for people in housing which was completely inappropriate, particularly where there was a disabled relative who they were caring for, where the doorways are too narrow, the stairs are inappropriate, and as most of you will be aware, falls are a major cause of death. So that needed something doing about it. So what have we done for women and children in the last week and coming up? Well, yesterday we had the debate in response to the inquiry into premature births. And it was really salutary, really awful stories of things that women were experiencing when they had a prem, and how actually the outcomes could have been much better for the mother and the baby. Heavily involved in the implementation of the Domestic Abuse Act, and we're not going to let that question go away. Children's Wellbeing and Education Bill, I had amendments down last week, and as I said on Monday, I'm going to try to get England to implement the ban on smacking, which is in place in Wales and in Scotland, so that children have equal protection from assault. Because you can hit the living daylights out of a child in England, quite frankly, and providing you don't leave a mark, it's really difficult to prosecute. And when you've got children with skin of colour, the bruises don't show, so people don't see them. Children going to school with really bad bruises, when you've got skin of colour, it doesn't show up as much as it does on a white skin like mine. So we really have got to do something about protecting children. In the employment bill, we're trying to increase the status of carers. Nearly all the carers across the country in social care are women. They've been low status. I'm trying to get education and training for them. And we got a concession out of the government on Thursday. So we're just squeezing in there and pushing at that. And then the last one was the Data Use and Protection Bill. And you may be aware that there's been all this trouble over copyright protection for creatives, for artists, designers, filmmakers, and so on. And the AI learning is to be able basically to steal their ideas, teach AI, and we've been resisting that really hard. Baroness Kidron has been leading on that, and a group of us behind the scenes have been trying to do something about it. So just to show you the parliamentary procedure and why I think it matters, bills go through different stages in legislation. It's not just straightforward. They kind of go round this hoop. The problem in the House of Commons with committee stage, because in the House of Lords we're a self-regulated House, is that it isn't the whole House that's necessarily involved. So that's been quite major with the terminally ill adults bill at the moment. And when it comes to report stage, the Speaker in the House of Commons selects amendments and what's there for debate and voted on. The good thing about the House of Lords is we're self-regulating, so nobody tells us what to do. If we decide we want to debate something, we debate it, even if we're there all night. We keep going. And then if we don't like what the House of Commons has done to legislation that we've been involved in, we send it back to them and they might send it back to us, which is called ping pong. And the latest time that we tried to do that over the data protection, we broke most of the conventions because we sent it back for a fourth time and we still won. So we won 221 and the government only had 116, and they tried really hard to push their vote up, but they couldn't. And we persuaded a lot of people to stay away. It is crucially important. This is an Elon Musk, President Trump. Perhaps I shouldn't be saying that openly. Oh dear, because this is being recorded. Whoops. Too late. I won't get a visa to go into America, will I? Whoa. But we are really worried that the AI stealing of the creatives, creativity, is going to be a big problem, whereas people need to earn their living out of the artwork and creative music industry and everything. And Elton John's been fantastic because, as he said, it's not for him. He's got the money he needs. It's for the next generations coming up who are starting out, who need to make a living out of their creativity and not have their creativity stolen. So what have I got coming up? What have we all got coming up? I think the danger with the assisted dying bill, and I've written a book which has been on sale here, and it's written by people from both sides of the debate, is because on balance, the bill that's before us will harm more people than it will help. That's kind of summarising all the objections. I could talk for 4 hours about the problems with that bit of legislation. I want to ban smacking. There are better ways to discipline children and help them understand what's going on. I want carers' rights to improve. Carers, unpaid carers, nearly all the unpaid carers are women. And it's all taken for granted. And then the other thing is about family contact centres. There are women looking after children, knowing that the father is not safe for the children to be left with. Family contact centres are really important to protect children, particularly girls, if there have been questions. You all know the type of questions over some of the things that have happened. So we really are moving things forward. We keep trying and we just never give up. And Chloe, sitting at the desk with the long hair, is the senior clerk to the parliaments. So she's the senior lawyer that makes sure that everything goes right. And when I, as a deputy speaker, makes a mistake, she's frantically signalling to me. And the other day I had to apologise to the House because I got things wrong. But so be it. That's life. We all make mistakes. Thank you so much for listening.